Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, check out everything else that is going on over there. The Craft of Preaching. You can check out all the videos, all the articles. And you can go over to YouTube and see what we're doing over there. Chad's putting up a video every week. We have a series that we're producing on a pretty regular basis that only appear on YouTube. So make sure that you go and subscribe and ring the bell for the YouTube channel. We are in the episode where we start a new book. So it's exciting to start a new book. Now, it seems like we just started a new book because we did, like a month ago. We're going to be in this one for a little bit longer.
Yeah, like weeks longer, months longer.
Yeah, and this one even has a sequel.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, I was thinking, you know, we're sort of... I mean, we're not near the end of the historical books. We're sneaking up on it.
Yeah.
I mean, the time you get to the end of 2 Kings, well, you got Ezra and Nehemiah, but I mean, we're a lot closer, let me put it that way.
Yeah.
A lot closer now. We're closer to the end of the historical period than we are to the beginning, put it that way.
Yeah, we're getting closer to some, you know, some angry prophets. It's going to be good.
Yeah. Yeah, this is true. We got the song. Yeah, we got so much good stuff coming up. I mean, things we haven't really touched on that much. We got wisdom literature.
Yeah.
You know, we'll have Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and we got we've had some songs, you know, had the song at the sea and stuff like that. We got one come up here in 1 Samuel. But we got like 150.
Yeah.
That we'll be covering. So I don't know how old we're gonna be when we get there. I was talking to my wife last night. She said, "So y'all been doing the podcast for what, 2.5 years?" I said, double that. Yeah. Yeah. I think we released the first one in January of 2015, I believe.
Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah.
So over 5 years now.
Yeah.
Goodness.
Yeah. So if we're being generous, what, we have maybe a third way done?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see that.
Yeah,
we'll
say we're a third. Way done. I mean, so I think we got 10 more years of this at least.
Yeah. So plenty of time. Plenty of time.
We'll see if we can wrap
about the time, up. I'll be ready to retire.
But to say, if we can wrap this up before Chad retires, that'd be good.
Yeah, I'm 50 right now. So, oh, yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
We'll be done by retirement for sure.
Okay, that's good. That's good. So, all right, so then we have the first chapter of 1 Samuel, man. Let's do it.
First of all, the name, it's kind of a strange name when you think about it. We're just so used to saying it that it probably doesn't strike us as odd. But it really is, because the man after whom both these books are named dies in chapter 25 of the first volume. So, yeah, we call him 1 and 2 Samuel, but Samuel isn't even around in 2 Samuel. He dies in chapter 25 of 1 Samuel. So it's kind of strange. Like, why would they name these books after this guy? Well, I think there's probably a couple of reasons. I mean, the most obvious is, yeah, he's a main character. He's a pivotal character, especially in the first third to two-thirds of the first book. And he's that transitional figure between that crazy period of the judges and the coming period of the monarchy. And there's a couple of references in the Old Testament, one in 1 Samuel, one in 1 Chronicles, that talks about him writing. So in chapter 10 of 1 Samuel, it mentions that he wrote some stuff in a book about the kings and their duties. And then 1 Chronicles chapter 29 says that the acts of David are written in the records of the seer Samuel. So did Samuel write some stuff down? Yeah, yeah. Did he write 1 and 2 Samuel in their entirety? No, that would be impossible, because he wasn't even around for a lot of what happened. But I think we talked about this when we covered Ruth, that, yeah, you could call the book Ruth. You could also call it Naomi, or you could call it Boaz, because all three of them are pretty important characters. But I think a person could make a pretty good case if we were going to, like, rename these books, not to call them 1 and 2 Samuel, but to call them 1 and 2 David.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if there is like a central character, it's David, without doubt. I mean, Saul is important. Samuel's important. But the whole history here is set up to lead toward King David. So First and Second David would be, I think, a more appropriate name, just as far as the content goes. But nobody evidently agrees with me, because of all the names that are out there, First and Second David are not among them. The Greek translation, the Septuagint, groups together. So our Bible, our English Bibles are different than the Greek and the Latin. So the Greek calls First and Second Samuel and First and Second Kings. It calls all of those together the Book of the Kingdoms. So you got like Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta. So you got these four books. So it understands, in other words, from First Samuel all the way to Second Kings is one book, one united history. Which, I mean, makes sense, because it is that kind of narrative. And then you get to the Vulgate, which is the Latin translation. And it's similar. I mean, it calls it like 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 3 Kings, 4 Kings. So different names out there, but it's just, as far as the content goes, definitely David is the one who is the prominent person here.
It seems like maybe one of the reasons that they go with Samuel is because Samuel does mark a pretty pivotal transition in the life of Israel. I mean, obviously there's people who would say, like, well, that transition really starts with David, but it doesn't. I mean, it really starts with Samuel. Samuel is the, because we're going to mean they get through Saul and all this as well. But after you have the judges, nothing is the same after Samuel. Everything's different after Samuel, because Samuel is sort of your first, also, you know, capital P prophet. Right, I mean, people would say, "Oh, you know, Moses is a prophet," but Moses is sort of his own thing in Israel's history. I mean, he's a prophet, he's a rescuer, he's everything, right? I mean, so Moses, there is no other Moses, but Samuel really is the first of God sort of having a mouthpiece, like a singular, like I said, that maybe there's other, you know, other prophets, but this is the prophet, right? And we haven't really seen that up until this point. And this is the reason that, and we'll see that people listen to him, and this is sort of, maybe not unanimously, but for the most part, he is viewed as the guy who speaks for God. And really, since Moses, we've not really had someone like that.
No, we haven't. I mean, there's been mention of a couple of prophets in the Book of Judges, but there's not none by name, and none that certainly stand out the way that Samuel does. I mean, he really does. He is a mosaic sort of figure, just in the sense that he isn't just a preacher like some of the other prophets were, but he is a leader. I mean, people look up to him, and
you can't have a David if you don't have a Samuel first,
right?
Because only Samuel's picking David,
right? Yeah, somebody has to have that horn of oil with which to anoint the king,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And so in this sense, Samuel is a pretty pivotal person in the genealogy of Christ, and certainly in the redemptive narrative. God got to get him a Samuel before he can have a line of David.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah, and his relationship with kings also kind of sets the pattern that we're going to see in the other prophets. The other prophets that figure in the books of Samuel and Kings, people like Elijah and Elisha, because almost from the get-go, there is this, I don't want to say antagonism, but there's a very tense relationship, let's put it that way. There's a very tense relationship between prophet and king, because you have, everything's okay as long as the king is doing what he's supposed to do according to the Torah. But the minute that he goes astray, who's going to be calling him on the carpet? It's the prophet. And they're fearless in doing so too. Well, most of them, the true prophets are anyway. You know, there's some other prophets later on in the Book of Kings who are nothing but, you know, yes sir men, saying what the king wants him to say. But the true prophets are always bold and fearless in standing up to the monarchy and saying, nope, what you did was wrong. I mean, we see that in the case of Samuel and Saul. We see that in the case of David and his prophets. And we see it in the case of Elijah and Elisha repeatedly telling the kings, what you're doing is not right. threatening them, all those kinds of very bold proclamations from God. So Samuel begins that process that we're going to see perpetuated by the other prophets as well.
Yeah. His origin story is a story that's got all kinds of Christological implications.
Yeah, definitely so. I mean, I don't know. I think probably my favorite chapters, at least in 1 Samuel, are the ones that we're about to get to. This first and second chapter are just amazing. Just the way the story is told and the characters in it. And then chapter 2, you have Hannah's song, which has a remarkable affinity with, of course, Mary's song, Magnificat.
Yeah.
I think it's without a doubt that Mary's is patterned after Hannah's. And there's connections between, we'll get to this when we get to chapter 2, but there's connections between Hannah's song and one of the Psalms as well, where, you know, which came first, you know, chicken or egg kind of situation. Did Hannah pattern hers after this Psalm, or was the Psalm patterned after Hannah's? But anyway, beautiful, beautiful expression of this great reversal, the topsy-turvy ways of God kind of flipping everything upside down. So some good theology of the cross stuff that we'll get to as well.
Yeah, and a passage that everyone heard when they were a kid about being willing to have the Lord use you. And
Yes, exactly.
A real Sunday school story.
A real Sunday school story. Yeah, we got it. So we have a whole list of characters here that we're introduced to in the opening chapter. We're going to meet a family with a man and two wives. We're going to meet them right away in these opening two verses. So we're going to get introduced to Elkanah, who is the husband and father, and his two wives, Hannah and Peninnah, or Peninnah, however you want to say her name. And we'll talk about them. But we're also introduced in this first chapter to Eli, who is going to be pretty prominent in the first third of 1 Samuel. And then also, there's not much made of his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, at this point. But we will hear more about them in the ensuing chapters. But we're introduced to almost everybody who's going to be a significant player early on, just in these opening verses. But then it will focus back in on Hannah in particular and the situation that she finds herself in. So let me read these opening few verses, just kind of set the stage for us. There was a certain man from Ramathaim Zophim, that's later just going to be called Ramah, from the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuth, an Ephraimite. And he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the other name of the other was Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this man would go up from his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests to the Lord there. And when the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and all her sons and her daughters. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion. I want to come back to that because the Hebrew there is uncertain and different translations render that different ways. But just read what I have. To Hannah, he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah. But the Lord had closed her womb. Her rival, however, would provoke her bitterly to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. And it happened year after year, as often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she would provoke her. So she wept and would not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? So that's the opening 8 verses. So I love this comment by one of the commentators I was checking out on this, just about the opening verse where you have Elkanah's genealogy listed. The quote is this: the names in Elkanah's genealogy are important because of their unimportance. So in other words, this guy is basically just an average Joe. You know, yeah. It's not like he has this awesome pedigree with all of these just sterling examples of courage and piety and all of this great family tree. We're like, oh man, he's connected to him and to him and to him. No, we read this and we're like, I don't know, never heard of those guys. No idea who they are.
Yeah, he's just a regular dude with some household conflict.
Just a regular dude with the kind of conflict that we have come to expect. It's like any time we meet a guy with two or more wives, we just automatically can safely assume, oh, yeah, well, there's going to be conflict, right? Like, as soon as we hear, and he had two wives, like, full stop, you're like, oh, I know what's about to happen. We have some problems.
Yeah, it's a weird, he's got an interesting thing going on. Seems like an all right guy. He's not upset that his wife is barren or doesn't seem to be blaming her for it or something like that. None of that.
That's kind of new, right? I mean, a lot of times we kind of have the opposite.
Yeah, or that he oddly enough prefers the barren wife to the one who can give children. Of course, this is the root of all kinds of problems. So as a way to try to, you know, make her feel better that since she can't have kids, he's given her more stuff. But of course, this is not helping at all, because then the wife who can have kids is upset about this, which is understandable. And so she uses the fact that she can provide offspring as a way to jab at her. Yeah, but this dude, while seems like an all right guy, not terribly bright, maybe, because he should know that he needs to at least do that stuff secretly. Like, you know, you're causing tension here, man.
Yeah. Yeah, he evidently had never read Guide to the Polytheistic Husband.
Yeah. You have to at least have the appearance.
It was all in chapter one.
You have to at least have the appearance of everything being equal.
Yeah. I think I mentioned this novel before. I read it years ago, The Lonely Polygamist, which was set in, I think it was Utah. Anyway, just one of these fascinating accounts of it's fiction, but just of the kind of the way this all worked between the husband and the many wives. So yeah, that's we've encountered, of course, the situation before with Jacob and his two sister wives and the jealousy that went between them. And it's a parallel there because of course Jacob loved Rachel more than he loved Leah, but Leah was the one who was able to produce all these children. Even though we're not told that Leah was as provocative as Peninnah is.
No, Leah seems like someone who ultimately just kind of got the shaft. I can't help but feel bad for Leah throughout that entire narrative, man. It seems rough.
It is. Yeah. And I think that I think it's written in such a way that we are actually supposed to feel pity for her. And I love the fact that just in the great scheme of things that ultimately the Messiah did not come from the tribe of Joseph, but it came from the tribe of Judah. And Judah was one of Leah's sons. So it's pretty cool the way that the Lord took care of her, as it were, in the grand narrative of salvation. But here we have a little bit different situation. So we have Elkanah, the two wives, and immediately we're introduced to their worship practice. So we don't know how prevalent this was among the Israelites at this time. Of course, if you were with us in Judges, you realize that it was just kind of a free-for-all. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes, and so you have people hiring these priests who were just looking for a job, and they set up their own little shrine, worship a little Yahweh, worship a little Baal, worship a little Asherah. So you have widespread syncretism. Nobody was really going. I shouldn't say nobody, but there's no evidence of widespread worship activity at Shiloh, where the tabernacle was. People seemed to just be kind of doing their own thing. But kudos to this family. They are actually going to the tabernacle, and they're going up yearly. We don't know if this was like some designated time, Passover or one of the other festivals, but they would go up yearly to worship and to sacrifice there at Shiloh. And when they went up, as I alluded to earlier, it's a little bit difficult to know how to translate this. I only mention it because depending on which Bible you use, you're going to read something different there. So most translations will say in verse 5 that to Hannah, Elkanah would give a double portion. But there are, I think it was the RSV. I don't know if I've got it here. Yeah, the RSV, for instance, reads, although he loved Hannah, he would give Hannah only one portion because the Lord had closed her womb. The trouble there, it's too complicated in the Hebrew to explain it on the podcast, but there is a word in there which just is a little bit hard to understand how to fit it into there. But it seems anyway that double portion is probably the better way to go here. So anyway, that's what he would do. He would give to her probably the stubble portion. And we know explicitly that he loved her. And evidently, you know, the other wife would take advantage of this situation to basically engage in that, what the Germans call with that wonderful word, Schadenfreude, right? This delight at somebody else's misfortune. So she would irritate her, provoke her. The Hebrew there is interesting because rival is literally something like troubler. So her troubler would provoke her. The verb for provoke is used almost exclusively in the writings before this to talk about how the Israelites would provoke God to jealousy by their idolatry. It occurs over and over in the Pentateuch. It's to refer to not how like one person would provoke another person, but how Israel would ka'as God because of their idolatry. But that's kind of what's going on here. And this would happen to irritate her. I was trying to think of how I might translate this. It's a little bit difficult to render, but the word that's translated as irritate usually means like to thunder or like shake in some way. So you kind of picture her provoked so much that she's either shaking on the outside or she's shaking on the inside. It's like this thunderous response to this constant poking at her and irritating of her because of the situation that she really had nothing to do with. So anyway, that's what would happen. They go up year after year. And finally it says that she would weep. She would not eat because of course she was just in what we would call a depressed state. And then Elkanah, I mean, I'm sure he meant well, but you know, speaking as a man, like a lot of husbands, you might mean well, but sometimes the things you say or you do are not very wise. And so,
you mean you're rolling in and be like, "You don't need kids, you got me."
yeah, like, listen, I'm the only man in your life that you really need. You know, we encountered an expression like this actually in the last episode. Remember, the women of Bethlehem said to Naomi that Ruth is better to you than seven sons. Well, Elkanah like takes that up three more. It's like, well, listen, I mean, I'm better to you than ten sons, right? I'm like, I'm God's gift to you. Why would you need anything else? So he's a little obtuse here. Just doesn't really get it. Doesn't help the situation. So anyway, that's kind of where we're at. So what's going to happen next is what all of this has been leading us toward. So Hannah, she gets up. My translation, I don't think is a good way to render this because it says, then Hannah rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh. The ESV is better here because it says that after they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Because I don't think that Hannah had been eating and drinking. We're just told that she wouldn't eat. And a few more verses, it says, when she's going to reply to Eli that she hasn't been drinking. So don't get the idea that, you know, Hannah had a lot to eat and she had a glass of wine and she thought she'd go pray. No, everybody else is eating and drinking. She's not. She's fasting. She's refraining from alcohol. So she gets up and it says that Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. This is unusual because the word translated there as seat, yeah, that's ESV and New American Standard both have that, almost exclusively refers to a throne. It's the Hebrew word kisei. And with, I think, possibly one other exception, every reference to this is to a throne, which makes me wonder if this isn't sort of an implicit way of saying that the priest was acting as if he were a king. Possibly. But that is the implication. That's the usual translation of this Hebrew word, kisei, is throne. Here it's translated as seat.
It's the closest thing they got, I guess.
I suppose.
No. We're still in the time of there is no king in the land. Not yet. So
Eli's kind of acting like he is. So he's sitting by the doorpost at the, this is another kind of strange word here, the temple of the Lord. Well, there's no temple. This is at this point, it's just a tent. It's a movable sanctuary. This word hakal is most of the time, again, used in reference to the actual permanent structure of the temple. But whatever reason, it's used here. And then I think one other place in these opening chapters to refer to the tabernacle rather than the temple. Anyway, she was bitter of soul, and she prayed to the Lord, and she wept bitterly. And verse 11 is significant, because this is where she makes a vow to the Lord, saying, you know, if you will do this, then I will do this. So verse 11 says, she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head. Now, we've encountered vows before. If you remember one, it's probably the vow that Jacob made when he was at Bethel. Vows typically work like this. And there's a lot of vows in the Old Testament. We don't really talk that much about vows these days in Christianity, but there's vows all over the Israelite world. Vows usually work like this. It's an if then. So if God will do X, then I will do Y. Or if God will give me X, then I will give him Y. Right? Those all kinds of situations like that we encounter in the Old Testament. Now, this one is unique because notice how it's different. Hannah does not say, if God will give me X, then I will give him Y. Hannah says, if God will give me X, then I will give him back X. So in other words, if God will give me this gift, then I will give this gift directly back to him.
Yeah.
It's a very different and I would argue a very superior vow in that way. So she's basically asking God for a child with the promise that this child that he has gifted her will then be gifted directly back to him for service, not just service, but also to be a Nazirite. Even though that word is not used anywhere in these opening chapters, I don't know how else we can understand this, because it says a razor shall never come on his head. And we know that Nazirites, like Samson, could not have a haircut, or could not come into contact with the corpse, or could not ever partake of any fruits of the vine. So it seems that just as Samson was a lifelong Nazirite, so also Samuel is going to be one as well.
Yeah, this is similar to you saying, telling God, if you give me a daughter, I'll make her a nun.
Yes, that would be a very close equivalent to this. I mean, that's basically what she's saying, right?
Yep.
I want a son, and she does end up, you know, when she has the son, she keeps him until he's weaned. But after that, he's turned entirely over to the Lord's service. So she makes the vow, and it says that as she was praying before the Lord, that Eli, so she's evidently right in front of the tabernacle, and Eli's watching her. He says, he's watching her mouth move. And Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. And so Eli assumes that she was drunk. This is kind of a strange situation here. First of all, I'm almost positive that there are no other examples in the Old Testament where we have prayer happening like this. I mean, we might pray that way, where, you know, we're not saying the words aloud, but maybe we're mouthing them, as it were. We're praying silently, but our lips are moving. But most of the time, when people pray in the Old Testament, it's aloud. It's out loud, at least in the examples that we're given. People typically actually give voice to their prayer.
Chad,
but she's not.
Chad, this is one of those unspoken prayer requests. You've heard of these in church. If you have an unspoken prayer request, just, you know, raise your hand. Yeah. And we'll pray for that too.
Right. Yeah. The Lord knows.
The Lord knows. So this is one is she's thinking about it. She's praying, but she's not speaking it. Yeah.
People do that on social media all the time, right?
All the time.
Yeah.
Just ask for prayer generically. Yeah. And I have no idea what I'm praying for.
Right. So when I see those and I do pray, I just pray. Lord have mercy. Yeah, whatever the situation might be.
Yeah. So I mean, you could see why. I don't know. Maybe this is something that, you know, you have her husband coming in saying, "Hey, I'm better than 10 sons," and maybe she doesn't want her sister wife here and her interceding for a child. I don't really need tool in your hand to stab me with. So there's a number of reasons why, as she's sort of, you know, presenting to God this vow, that she might want that just to be between her and God, and not want it to be something that her husband hears and then thinks, man, she's just really, really, really discontent and upset. Yeah. And nor does she want, you know, her co-wife to hear this either, because she doesn't need to give her more fuel.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that makes perfect sense. You ever been in one of those? I've been in two situations. I just thought of this. It's kind of a side note, but you ever been in those situations where you're in a group and everybody's praying together aloud, but their own prayers?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know how common that was. I've only been in two situations like that where it was, you know, one was in Russia. I was in Novosibirsk, Siberia, and I attended a German service, actually. I mean, they were Russians, of course, but they came from German heritage. And so all of their liturgy, their hymns and prayers were still in German. And there was one point in the service where we all kneeled to pray and everybody prayed aloud their own prayers. So it was kind of this cacophony going on inside the church. And then one other situation that was like that. But yeah, it just wasn't something I was used to.
I've had that happen. Growing up, sometimes that would happen in more charismatic churches, but I think it's even in less charismatic churches, I think it's sometimes a cultural thing. It's not necessarily theological, always anyway. It's cultural. Yeah. So I think South Korea, if you were to go to churches there, a lot of them do that. So they'll say, "Let's pray." I was at an event with all South Koreans and me. It was like that. They were praying before the service, and they all got together, and I was there, and they said, "Let's pray," and I was not ready for it. And all of a sudden, just everybody starts praying, you know. And yeah, it's, yeah. You know, it's not right or wrong or anything, but if you're not expecting it, you're like, whoa.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was kind of like that too. But I just thought of that when we were covering, you know, the silent prayer as opposed to the prayer.
The very vocal prayer. So this is the opposite of that. But,
the opposite.
Which by the way, I would be more familiar with. Like, hey, let's all get together and pray for the service. And if you got a bunch of people in a circle and they decided they were all going to pray, I would assume that we were all about to pray silently.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least one person prays for everyone there. Well, don't you love Eli too? I mean, his immediate assumption is, oh, she's drunk. Yeah. Yeah, what a... She can't catch a break, you know. Her husband is just a little bit, you know, slow, not the best comforter. Then her co-wife is a constant irritant, and now her pastor thinks she's drunk when she's pouring her heart out before God. It's like, poor Hannah, my goodness. No one's being really that kind and friendly to her. So he says, "How long will you make yourself drunk? Put away your wine from you."
Yeah, so he doesn't just think to himself that she's drunk.
No, he like rakes her over the coals. Drunkard, what are you doing?
This man, clearly not a prophet.
Yeah, exactly. So Hannah says, "No, my Lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit." Literally like hard or severe in spirit. Not really sure how to render that in English, but oppressed in spirit, heartbroken, something like that. "I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink." So this is that strong drink is the one we talked about before, shekar, which is probably beer. So I haven't had a beer. I haven't had a glass of wine. Nothing. "But instead, what have I done? I have shafak. I poured out my soul before the Lord." Kind of a play there. I have not been pouring drinks, dear priest, and said, "I've been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant," and she uses a great phrase here, a daughter of Belial, which is translated as worthless woman, at least in my translation. Yeah, worthless woman at the ESV as well. So, but literally, it's don't consider your servant a daughter of Belial, which is Belial over time came to actually become a name that was applied to the devil. At this point, it just kind of means, yeah, worthless. So sons of Belial were worthless fellows, just good for nothings. And I guess the daughter of Belial had the same connotation. So don't consider me that way, because I've spoken out of my great concern and provocation. Now, so Eli realizes his, go ahead.
Well, no, I actually love the way that the ESV translates this, because one, because we know that God is going to answer this prayer. So sorry if I ruined the whole thing, but God's going to answer this prayer. And when she's talking to the priest, the way the ESV translates this is, "Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman. For all along I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation." But what you have is that one, that she, what she says she's doing, her own admission, is that she's speaking to God, pouring out her heart, and what she's doing is venting out all this anxiety and vexation. And you might feel like this would sort of be a worthless endeavor, or this makes you sort of a worthless person. Like, I'm just praying to God. The only thing that's coming out of my mouth is all this anxiety and all this vexation that I have. But because God answers this prayer and we see Eli's response, which is going to be, "Go in peace, the God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him." So in that sense, you're given permission to bring all your anxieties, as we know Jesus is going to say, "Cast your cares upon me," or "Don't be anxious," and this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But you also have this thing where vexation and anxiety are subjects of prayer for Hannah, right? And these aren't worthless things to do.
Yeah.
This is a very good thing to do.
And I suspect she's talking to her, no, that she's talking to God, not just about kind of a generic, "Oh, I'm just feeling anxious," but she's probably talking to her about her co-wife. Mm-hmm. I say that because the word translated there is vexation, is the same word that's used to describe how she would vex her or provoke her or irritate her earlier in verse 6. So yeah, I mean, she's like, she's doing what the Psalms always do, right? They name names. Yeah. So-and-so is bothering me, or this particular nation is afflicting us, whatever it might be. I mean, we've talked about this before. I think we talked about it with Naomi, that we do have this idea that we need to kind of whitewash our prayers and pretty them up and make sure we don't say anything to God that's you know, a little bit too much like complaining or venting. Yeah. It's all over the Psalms, people.
Yeah, well,
people,
I mean,
are venting it's, all the time.
It's this. I mean, if you don't have Hannah willing to take her anxiety and vexation to God, then you don't get Samuel and you don't get David. And I think we know who you don't get if you don't get David. So we really need Hannah to take her anxiety and vexation to God.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, out of her lament came forth this answer to prayer, which of course leads to the promise of the Messiah himself.
Yeah. And Eli's response for blowing it on the front end is pretty good on the back end.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it is. He says, you know, "Go in shalom," right? "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant your petition that you asked him." Now, we won't have time today to come back to that particular Hebrew verb for ask, but it's actually going to become very significant later on. Sha'al is the word there. It's going to come up at the end of the chapter. But yeah, he responds much better now. Basically, "I want you to go from this place in peace, knowing that God is going to answer your prayer." And she responds, "Well, let your maidservant find favor in your sight." So she went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So evidently, and this is one of these situations that the words spoken by another person is stronger than any reassurance we might give ourselves in our own heart, right?
Well, it's interesting that God is going to answer her prayer, but this is a nice example that you have in Scripture where it doesn't say, "And then the Lord spoke to Hannah and said, I've heard your petition, go home, you know, your request will be answered," or whatever. Instead, he uses a dude that can't discern whether someone's praying or drunk to give her a word of encouragement and a word of grace, right? But it says, no, he puts his word in the mouth of Eli, then, and this is the preacher, right? So he puts it in the mouth of the imperfect preacher to say, your prayers are heard.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I had in mind the it's a Bonhoeffer quote, right? That the word spoken by a brother is stronger than the word I speak in my own heart, right? It's just that the power of that external word of someone saying God's word to us, putting, actually speaking it aloud into our ears. And it has, I mean, it has that immediate effect on Hannah, because it's like, she believes it, you know, she trusts that God has spoken to her through this priest. And all of a sudden her countenance has changed. She goes to, she's going to eat now. She's no longer going to fast because she's trusting in this, the word that the priest has spoken to her.
Yeah.
And I guess we're going to save the rest of the story for next week.
That's it, man. Guys, if you know anyone that would like to join join you in listening to the podcast, now's a great time to share it with people, put it on social media, starting a new book. So you tell people, hey, crucial change is coming for Israel. Now's a good time to jump in the podcast. If you're like, I'm just too far behind, I just can't do it. Well, the beginning of a book is the best time to share it. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. We'll see you then.